This is S.M. Sterling, and you're listening to Through the Aftermath.
Welcome back, everyone, to this 29th episode of Through the Aftermath. I'm your host, Sean, and with me, once again, is Jonathan. How are you doing, Jonathan?
Woohoo! I figured I'd start with something other than fantastic. Didn't want the SEC on me.
Equally as excited, though.
That's right. Equally as excited and still don't hate anything yet.
So how you doing? What have you been up to these last couple weeks?
Yeah, no, it's been a busy couple of weeks. I mean, work's been busy, but my goodness, you know, kind of going back to what I think we briefly mentioned last time. What's up with all these great games coming out? I mean, it's like one after the other, and just when you're broke from buying the four you wanted, four more show up on pre-order on Steam, and you're like, oh, that's great, you know, thanks a pat load. So yeah, it's. Kind of bouncing around the single player world, still playing Fallout 2, which has been a blast, and Fallout Tactics, which I'm still like giddy to death and surprised I completely missed most of it. But the Fallen Earth world pulled me back in, and it's especially after that patch, they've just redone some of the added more to the new starter areas, yeah. Especially in the outlying areas. Fallen Earth, that is one game where I have never canceled my sub, even the times I don't play, because I feel like I'm sort of like giving money to the new order. I don't know. It's like the Brotherhood of Steel in a way.
But I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's been good. I mean, it's been a lot of fun. You know, Fallout 3. I still I haven't been playing my PS3 in some time. It's been mainly PC gaming recently. And you know, I guess this ties into the post-apocalyptic thing. Global Agenda. I jumped on board. You know, after you and I had talked a little bit about it, and that game is a blast.
Yeah, it really is. Now, I guess to tie that into the post-apocalyptic thing, that is actually like way, way, way in the future where, you know, everything has been rebuilt and the game is it centers around fighting over resources because resources are so scarce. So you're fighting these giant PvP battles, well, not giant, but pretty big PvP battles with alliance versus agency versus agency and alliance versus alliance, and you're fighting over the map. And whoever controls, like you can fight over an area that has mines, and then now you have those resources. You can fight over an area that has like a production facility, and now you can actually produce, you know, from the so it's actually it's pretty cool, and it's based on kind of a scarcity of resources. So it's definitely very post-apocalyptic, but
yeah,
I think a lot of people miss that because it has such a high like action factor. You know, you jump in and you're just firing away, and it's pretty intense.
Yeah, it's kind of planet side-ish, but to call it that would be not correct, because you know the kicker for me is the jetpack factor really adds a whole new element, and it's almost like you want to call it, you know, part tabula rasa, part, you know, persistent world planet side, except for the, you know, parts in between where nobody's doing anything. Like this one's a lot more controlled. It's almost got like a piece of Guild Wars in there because you got the social areas and then you break off into missions and other areas. But woo, yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's, you know, I like the utopian world, the whole Orwellian world where everything is like big brothers watching except they're corporations and stuff. Yeah. I dig on that a lot. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely very utopian apocalypse, yeah. And you know I'm a big fan of more of the scavenging apocalypse, I guess, but it's still really fun. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's been a great game.
Cool. So
and what about you?
For me, let's see. I've been playing a lot of Fallen Earth. Actually, I have a Choose My Adventure group. I know I've talked about before in Fallen Earth, and it's ending next week.
I'm sad.
Yeah, I'm not really too sad because I know I'll still be playing. I just won't be writing about it. I guess that's the only thing. But I really get a kick out of a lot of the comments that people say. You know, I can't even count how many people have said that they now sub to this game because of that column, you know, where I would write – basically what it is I write like an in-character thing, and then I write you know, kind of my impressions of what we did that week. And I think it's pretty cool because a lot of people follow along with it and they say, you know, I didn't really even know that this part of the lore existed, because that's basically what I'm doing. I'm writing it from the perspective of some guy, a clone, who is just going right along with the lore. You know, I'm not making up the story. I'm just kind of reporting it, you know, like his version of going with Tetrax and, you know, and through the LifeNet facilities and everything like that. And there's a lot of stuff I didn't know either. You know, I'm basically kind of learning it. What I do, it's kind of funny. A lot of people say, like people who play with me in the group, they're like, how do you remember all this stuff to write it up later? And I said, well, I take screenshots of all the quest dialogue.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that's the best way to do it, because and it's amazing how much of a gem those screenshots will be years from now. You'll look back and go, oh, I think I remember that. And then you'll read the dialogue, and at the time it was arbitrary, but you'll go, that's right, I did tell that guy to do that with himself. You know, it's like, it's hilarious looking back.
Yeah, but it is really a great storyline in that game. It's one of the things I think a lot of people overlook, but it's been a lot of fun though. But yeah, that little Choose My Adventure group is going to end. And what's funny is this, I don't know if this episode will be out in time, but there's a party that we have planned for the finale on Saturday, let's see, the 27th of February. And it's going to be that the people get to vote on what kind of party it's going to be, which I think is going to be fun. Like, there's a pool party. You can either do a pool party at like Sunshine Corners, where they have this old pool, and it could be a bar party where there's a bar in New Flagstaff. There's a I wanted to do this. There's this town called Newton right in Sector 2, and it's overrun by infected. And they're all like really slow lumbering infected. You know, they don't really do anything, but there's a ton of them. And it's this town that's been taken over by them. So there's no NPCs there or anything. It's just these lumbering infected walking around.
Right.
So I'm thinking it would be cool to have a party there where you just sit there and play, like, you know, bash the infected or something like that.
So cool.
That would be like our little finale. We'd just sit there, and because you don't have to worry about them rushing at you and hurting you. I mean, you could plick them away from with your rifle, or you could run up to them and play, you know, like kind of like pinata, some of them. So I figured that would be kind of cool. There were a couple other options too. I had one to be a tea party, because there's a Barrett Manor is this place in Sector 2 that's like a, you know, a giant mansion. And I think it would be cool to have like a tea party kind of a event there. So basically, yeah, all these different types of things that I'm naming here, people will vote on which one we're going to do. And then we're going to meet up on Saturday and do that. So.
Oh, man. What time is your meeting? Because I'm curious, because this would be a hoot to be part of. And I'm going to be at NASCAR that day, but not till like later in the afternoon. Y'all be down in Las Vegas, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, this will be at 9 p.m. Eastern. So.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that'll be right in the middle of when I'm down there. Ah, sad.
Yeah. And actually, the Fallen Earth crew, the devs are giving me 50 those XP booster shots that like boost your XP. They're giving me 50 of those to hand out to people. I'm going to hand them out to the first 50 people who show up. So it should be a lot of fun.
Nice.
And I will try to get this out before then. Hopefully I will. Yeah, hopefully I should be able to get to, so that you know, the people in our old clan can kind of go out there and head out. Be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that'll be great. I'm excited to be, like, now that I'm full force into the game, and it's weird, because not to say that I'm like, I'm glad I waited, because it's not like that. You know, obviously it was kind of out of my control, but it's amazing coming back to it right now, just how much of it has changed, and they've really added on a lot of new stuff and to the newer areas, and it's almost like experiencing it again for the first time. And so it's almost, you know, obviously I'll have some catching up to do to catch up to the group, but, It's so refreshing to be running around in that world and go, that's right, you don't turn off when I turn the game off. This is good. You know, it's almost like Fallout that doesn't end. Wee, you know, but, so good, by the way. So yeah, no, it'll be, hopefully you'll see some more, of me online, especially running around with my bald head and little goatee and 3D glasses.
Cool.
So much fun.
Let's see. Other than that though, this hasn't really been a ton. I've been watching a few more Western movies. I think I mentioned that last time. I was really getting into them. And that parallel, I still make that parallel between post-apocalyptic and Westerns. It's just, I don't know, it's undeniable.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, and I think there that the more you mention it, the more I'm noticing it now. Almost like you like grabbed a hold of my head and were like, "Remember?" And I was like, "Oh no!" And I look, I see it. But no, you're exactly right. It's cool that kind of like, in fact, the show Firefly kind of plays into it, except more space based, but it's kind of this post apocalyptic. Well, somebody out there just went, "No, it's not." But I mean, you know, theoretically, because they land on planets that could be destroyed. I don't know. So yeah, no, it just shares that kind of cowboy stuff. Works great for everything. I dig that stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at like the Dark Tower series, Stephen King stuff. I mean, that's perfect.
So you've got sci-fi cowboy, you got post apocalyptic cowboy. I mean, it's great.
Yeah. But yeah, that's about all I've been up to. And I think before we get into the news, I want to mention what the show is going to be about. We're going to talk about S.M. Sterling's Dies the Fire, that book, of course. And now we're not going to talk about the entire Emberverse series because it's quite long.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's quite long, and we haven't read it all. And basically, you know, I just finished Dies the Fire not too long ago, and I wanted to talk about it before, you know, it escaped my old mind, which seems to happen a lot. So we'll be talking about that. And
Why you heard the intro at the beginning. You probably had noticed that intro at the beginning was one you'd heard before, but what a better time to use it than during his book. So
exactly, yeah. Six months later, here we are using it again.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, it's definitely timely now. But let's see. There's a little bit of news here before we get into the main topic. And one of the pieces of news is it's this link I'm going to put in the show notes, but it's a little bit more information on Fallout New Vegas. Do you want to talk a little bit about this? Because this is, I know that you are out of your mind excited about this.
Oh, yes. It's almost like, because, you know, I love the Fallout story in general, but again, you know, you probably heard me in the last one. And those of you who just rolled your eyes, come on. No, what it is, you know, you heard us mention in the last one that the developers from Obsidian, who are, you know, different, obviously, than Bethesda, who are making this one, are some of the original developers for especially Fallout 2. You know, they used to be part of Black Isle Studios. And so what we have here is essentially what was going to be the original Fallout 3, or at least fragments of it. And so, you know, I was just telling Sean before the show, just based on what I've heard in my prediction, is that you're going to probably find out that this game is going to be much more to the metal as far as the storylines of Fallout than even the original, you know, Fallout 3 was, which is saying a lot because it was, you know, for guys who didn't make the original game, they sure did do their homework very well. But this just has there's some elements that they've added that some are rumor, some are confirmed. We do know that and real quick, just touching on them, for those of you who are like, well, Fallout 3 didn't interest me, this game might, just simply because, you know, we do know that Vegas is part of a city that did not get hit, and so they have power. It's still around. It's kind of like more like Western, you know, saloon style, but the casinos are still there and everything. And we do know that you apparently play a courier who got knocked over the head on your way to deliver something, and you can't remember what it was or who. But the rumor, and it sounds like it's becoming less rumor and more for real, apparently there is going to be vehicles in the game because the area that you're covering is so gigantic that you actually probably need vehicles to get around. And so everybody keep your eyes open because PC Gamer Magazine has the cover story, and so does PlayStation Magazine and one for Xbox. Oh, what is it? OXM, I guess, or OXE or OX crap. Why didn't John check this out before he started talking about it? So, yeah, but it sounds like a lot of fun. It definitely it's relating more to the original Fallout world. And if Fallout 3 seemed to kind of bore you, you know, at times, because, you know, open-ended games are kind of, some people don't dig them, but this might be a little more story oriented for you, and I think we're going to have another gem underneath this. So I'm going to have to figure out a new tagline. Instead of "so good," I'll have to come up with something else that applies more to the Vegas side. I don't know. So
something, you got to say "so good" in like an Elvis voice or something.
Oh yeah, ladies and gentlemen, oh, so good. But not to sound uber geeky, but truth be told, this actually really does excite me, especially for all the original Fallout fans. This is really the kind of Fallout. It's almost like, okay, now it's like hand it back to the original guys, and those of you who were yelling because Van Buren, which was the code name for original Fallout 3 that never got made, can now be quiet because, you know, this is pretty much a lot of what they were planning to do with it. So, woohoo!
Yeah, definitely exciting. I can't wait to see. I hope, I really, really hope that they show Maybe something at E3 this year in June.
They better, dang it! You know, and I, you know, in fact, E3 in June is probably where we're going to see it, because I remember very, very well, because I started to tear up. No, not really. That when they first showed Fallout 3, and we do know that it is coming out this fall, out 3, which I'm sure they're going to play that one on the preview again. Ah, see what I didn't. Shouldn't have done there. It's literally, we know that we're probably going to see the E3 just because of that. And so that's great. I mean, we should be seeing the stuff ramping up here very quickly and good fun. Yeah. And, you know, like I said, for those of you who don't play it or have rolled your eyes when I have mentioned it, come on. Come on. You got to play it. So, yeah, there it is.
Cool. Let's see. Was there any other news that we're missing?
No, not other than the fact that you and I stumbled onto a rather interesting post-apocalyptic MMO.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's right. I actually, someone pointed this out to me. It's this game. It's this new MMO, and it's called, I think it's pronounced Scion.
It's almost like somebody tried to say Zion, but they tried to do it really fancy-like with a bad speaking spell.
Yeah, it's xsyon.com, and you can check it out. It's an MMO. It's supposed to be pretty open-ended. The way they describe it, it sounds like you can basically write your own story in it. I'm not sure exactly how it works.
It could even affect the terrain. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, and it's post-apocalyptic, and it's more of a, instead of a Mad Max kind of technological, scrapyard kind of post-apocalyptic, it's more of a tribal post-apocalyptic, which I think is really interesting. I'm a big fan of that kind of stuff. And there are some of the character models that they show on the website, and they have like scraps of metal mixed with fur. And I think that stuff is so cool. So it's, I don't know, like the pictures themselves don't look the greatest. It's definitely an indie game.
Yeah.
And
it looks like it comes out April 15th, by the way. It's on pre-order right now. So
yeah, there you go. Okay.
Yeah. Check the screenshots and see, cause they're, it's actually quite, though I'm going to use the word quaint, because I mean, for my first reaction is like, oh, but then if you think of it in the context of probably more of an indie, company, it's actually quite clever, and you almost, it's kind of a refreshing take on the post-apocalyptic world, and that alone might be warrant enough for me to take a much closer peek, just because it's like, ah, you did something interesting here.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't think the art is the greatest thing in the world, but I think that it's, wow, I just looked at a guy that was wearing a bone suit, complete bone suit. Anyway.
It's very Elod's kind of style, and notice I didn't say Warcraft there. I figured I'd evolve past that stereotype, so.
Yeah, it's very, it is kind of cartoonish. It's definitely not as bleak as Fallen Earth, but, I'm curious about it just from the standpoint of, I am so interested in indie MMOs these days and indie games period, because they've really been doing, making a name for themselves. So I'm really curious about this one. I'm going to keep my eye on it.
Yeah, there's a lot on it. I mean, just the open-endedness of it and the fact that you can affect the world in such a great deal. I'm like, hey, all right. So we'll see. Maybe that's the noise you make if you can't get into the beta. I don't know. Like, it's a giant.
Yeah, so check it out. XSYON.com, and see if it's something that you might be interested in.
Yeah, take a peek, and if the subscription numbers suddenly skyrocket, the developers I think should come on our show because of that.
Definitely. Okay, so let's see. I guess that's about it for this one for the news. So let's get into the main topic here. And it, of course, is S.M. Sterling's Dies the Fire. This is a book that came out in 2004, and it's considered an alternate history post-apocalyptic novel. And what that means is he writes about what happened back in 1998, even though he wrote this in 2004. And what it is it has a pretty interesting, which I think is one of the most interesting takes on how the world would end. And There's this thing that happens called the change, and he doesn't really describe it in scientific terms. Like, he doesn't say this is exactly how it happened, but he says the change happened. It was basically a big flash of light, and it makes all, like, electronics not work anymore. And it also it adds a really interesting part where it makes gunpowder not work anymore, like dynamite and any kind of gunpowder, bullets, anything.
Yeah, so, electricity doesn't even work.
Yeah, no electricity, no batteries, no gunpowder, no powder, and no explosives. So when you think about those, taking those elements out of society right now, I mean, that would be a lot. That would take away all guns, all any kind of anything with a flash, anything like that. And then, you know, of course, all the electronics, anything with a battery even. So you're left with not really a lot. You know, you still have all this stuff around. It's not destroyed, which I think is really interesting. You know, you have these parts you can use for whatever else you want to use them for, but they just don't work. They're just basically turned off. Mm-hmm. And I think I really, really like that premise of it, which is exactly why I grabbed this book. And also, we were actually recommended this by some listeners very early on in our show. I think one of the first shows somebody recommended this. So it took me a while to read it because I have a tendency of reading two or three books at a time. I don't know why I do that. I finally finished it not too long ago. And I think overall, my impressions of it – now, I don't want to get into, you know, it's a pretty recent book, so I don't want to get into the ending. You know, I don't want to give anything away. But I think it's a really an interesting book from a perspective that it's different, that it's not your normal nuclear war scenario or your, you know, water world or something like that. You know, it's nothing like that. It's a really kind of a unique idea. And not only the idea itself is fairly unique, it's not 100% unique, but it's fairly unique. But the way he writes the story, you know, he puts a lot into his characters, and he puts a lot into the research of a lot of, like, the way things would happen. Like, he doesn't just say, yeah, now we don't have guns and stuff, so we're going to grab some bow and arrows. Like, he describes the making of when they start making bows and arrows, and they use crossbows and things like that. He describes, like, he did his research on these things, you know, and it's really interesting. And when they start going into farming, he talks about it in detail, how they farm, how they, you know, determine the seasons and the crop rotation and all this kind of stuff. And this little society basically forms, the book is based on two groups. There's the Bear Killers, who are named because they encounter these bears at one point, or this bear at one point, and one of the guys actually kills it. So they name their little tribe the Bear Killers. And then there's the McKenzie clan, who is run by Juniper McKenzie, and she's kind of a Wiccan, kind of a modern age woman with I don't know how to describe it, I guess, but Wiccan is the big part of her life and the story and everything. So you have these two groups. They're in Oregon, and at one point they actually do meet, and this is an important part I'll talk about in a second, but the book follows these two groups and how they kind of survive. One of them does the farming off the land. One of them is a little bit more militaristic, where they actually – I mean, the guy who leads them, Mike is his name, he's an ex-Marine. So he – you know, they get together. They literally make chainmail, and they make plate armor that they put under their clothes. So they kind of go more towards this kind of medieval system, which I think is really interesting to point out the fact that this is probably where we would go if this happened. You know, we would go back to having pikes and halberds and plate mail, and then we would mix it up with some blue jeans or something. You know what I mean? I think it would be it's really interesting to think about that. And that's the part of this book that really attached to me the most, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting – like you said, it's an interesting story because it focuses – so much. Well, and I better set a stage here. I haven't actually read this book yet, but I know enough about the storyline to be dangerous. Like, I always joke with people, like, you know, growing up, I was people would come to me for the, you know, Nintendo codes and how to beat a level, but I never owned one. You know, until I was in junior high. How the hell do you know all this? You know? Oh, well, I just read a lot. You know, to set the stage here, you know, this is something where I've known the story quite well, and this is was, you know, listening to Sean, especially, you know, talk quite a bit about it, you know, in the past, it's really piqued my interest to want to take a peek. And for me, just looking at the overall story, you know, kind of piggybacking what you just said, for me, the thing that I think is most interesting is they don't focus so much on what happened. They just kind of focus more on there's a lot of these like different scenarios where it's almost like retreat groups, you know, just things that happen, like going hunting or the fact that they would be at war with another city who's – it's kind of like Jericho style without the everything being so happy. But it's very much to the metals, like survival, but not to the point of being that typical stereotype nuclear survivalist mentality. Yeah. It's almost like just, you know, obviously we didn't nuke each other, but we're in a kind of a falling apart world, you know, as if, you know, we lost all technology.
Yeah, and I think another part that I didn't mention yet is that this is actually based on another series that S.M. Sterling wrote before, where it was his Nantucket series is what it was called. And basically that was where this change happened just on Nantucket Island. And it sent these people from Nantucket Island. It sent them back to the Bronze Age. It actually sent them back in time. And Dies the Fire and the whole Emberverse series is supposed to be with when that change happened that sent them back in time, except what happened to everyone who stayed in the modern day. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think that's interesting that he was successful in this Nantucket series, and then he said, hey, what would happen to the people who are still here? You know, let's write about them. So I think that's really interesting that it's the same subject, but just kind of a different area.
It's almost like alternate universe, parallel universe kind of thing, because it's almost like you see things that are elements of our world, but it almost looks like, you know, maybe something in the timeline shifted this way just a tad. Well, and obviously the change was the shift, but I mean, like, just little subtle things, and that's what's interesting. Is it's you can see our world there, but it's almost like there's these elements that are like, oh, that's cool, almost like medieval style elements that added into it, and just the interaction between the groups.
It's kind of also, it reminds me of that movie Doomsday.
That's perfect. That's exactly right.
Yeah, where they kind of went back to that, you know, old feudal mentality and the medieval warrior. That's exactly what happened here too. And actually there's a little bit of similarity between the Postman too, where you have this kind of what was that guy's name, the bad guy in the Postman?
Bethlehem.
Yes, Bethlehem, that's right. I mean, there's kind of a Bethlehem-type character in this, although we don't really hear about him that much. But it's kind of, you know, and finishing the book up, it really makes me feel kind of incomplete, and it makes me feel like I want to keep reading, you know, the rest of the series. Of course, when he wrote it, he, you know, had the rest of the series in mind, so it works to get you to read the rest of them. But, you know, I want to know what happens to these people. I want to know how they go from here. And one, like I mentioned earlier about how the two groups, the Bear Killers and the Mackenzies, kind of met at one point. They kind of crossed paths. What was very interesting, this is the part of the plot that I really enjoyed the most. I'm not really giving anything away here, but when they met, they're the two leaders of each group. There's Mike, they call him like Lord Bear, and then they have Juniper Mackenzie, who is they call her Lady Juniper, and she's like the queen, I guess you could say, queen mother of this clan. When they meet each other haphazardly, they kind of have this fling thing. You know, it's not really that they fell in love or anything. They just basically have sex. And she becomes pregnant. They meet and then they go away. They just cross paths basically for a little while. So they don't stay with each other after that. So she becomes pregnant. And toward the end of the book, she actually has the child. And it makes me think, and of course I knew, you know, you figure it out once they meet like this. You say, I bet in the rest of the series, this child is going to be important. Like, this is the story of how this child was conceived, you know. And I don't know if that's true or not. So somebody out there who has read the rest of the books can set me straight on that. But if that's true, I think that would be really interesting, because it's an interesting story of how they met. And, you know, these people who literally, at the beginning of the book, the change was happening. So this isn't 200 years after the end of the world. This is immediately, you know, during and after the end of society.
That's right, because they're on an airplane when the change happens, doesn't it? Like, they almost crash.
Yeah.
Or, well, they do crash.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you can't almost crash. Okay. Whew.
But I think overall, I, you know, like, again, I haven't really described too much of this book because I don't want to give too much away. There's really a lot in there. Overall, if I were to review this book, I would say it's a really good book. It starts out really strong. It really gets me going, especially when they start describing the whole process when they start figuring out what they're going to do now. You know, they say, hey, well, this guy knows a little bit about farming. Let's figure something out here. This guy knows about this. So they actually have a guy in the group who is a horse breeder. So he, or a horse, I guess he's a horse breeder. And so he knows about horses. And that's what they have to use now. They have to use horses. And so I think it's interesting that they're kind of pulling the resources and just talking their way through that process. You know, Sterling does a great job of getting the details in. But here's the thing, is I think at some point he does a little bit too much. There's probably in the middle of the book to the second, I don't know, maybe like except for the very last quarter of the book, I would say that maybe the second and third quarter of the book is pretty boring, I think, because there's a lot of facts, there's a lot of, you know, this is what's happening now and this is how this is, and like there's a whole section on, he really gets into the Wiccan thing, and I realize that there aren't a lot of books like that, a lot of mainstream books that get into that, so I think he was probably using this opportunity to kind of get a lot of this information out that he was able to research. But there are oftentimes when one of the main characters, Juniper, kind of goes into this Gaelic speak for, you know, and then she'll say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I went into the Gaelic speak again, I'm going to go ahead and speak English now. And it's a little fakey to me. It's a little forced, and it seems like it gets a little old, I think, is what I'm trying to say. That's mm-hmm. the only part that really bothered me. It seemed like that kind of thing, it's like he researched the heck out of it, and then he was like, I need to use all this research and not let it go to waste, so then he threw it into the book, and it's like, you could have probably kept a lot of that out, you know what I mean? I appreciate mm-hmm. the fact that you researched it and you have all this information, but you probably would have been okay to just leave it as a story instead of a textbook, you know what I mean?
Well, and so, I wonder how much of that was because you can see, you know, and I know this just from the overall story, there is Tolkien references mm. all over the place. In fact, I think in one of the other books, there's even a reference to the Dúnedain. Yeah. Rangers. And I wonder if that had, you know, obviously he's paying homage to Tolkien. He may have been, you know, probably was inspired as a writer by Tolkien. And so he almost inherits some of that Tolkien-esque, you know, explain everything, including history to the point of there's just no way you can't know the whole story. But at times, you know, and I'm not dissing Tolkien here, you know, Tolkien can be tough to read for that exact reason.
Yeah. So. That's a good point. That is a good point. That's probably an inspiration there, I guess you could say. But even his Tolkien mentions, though, in the book. And what it is there's this little girl. Well, she's like 14, I believe. Her name is Astrid. And she is kind of the Tolkien geek in the book. And she is the one who teaches everyone how to use the bow and arrow because she learned herself. She wants to be Legolas, you know. And his references to Tolkien, I think, are spot on because they're kind of brief. They're almost like inside jokes where only people who really know Tolkien will get it. And like you said, they, you know, mentioned the Dúnedain Rangers, and that I think is perfect. And maybe it's because I'm a bit of a Tolkien nerd myself, and I'm like, yeah, I get that right there. But I like the fact that he didn't have to explain it like he did with the other stuff.
Right.
So I think if he would have kind of taken that approach to the rest of the things that he was explaining the heck out of, that it probably would have worked a little bit better.
Yeah, no, and you're exactly right. I mean, and that's the thing is, you know, there are some places in it, and it was almost a thing where, like you said, he may have just researched it and felt this, you know, need to over-explain it, you know, not so he didn't feel like he was, you know, dropping the ball on it or hadn't been, you know, you get some people like, you didn't do your homework before you wrote this, did you? But, you know, he wanted, you know, to cover the whole gamut of it. Sure. Although the Wiccan side of it, you know, that's that in and of itself is kind of an interesting angle to it. But like you said, maybe some of it, you know, could have been passed over a little quicker.
Well, and also, I just thought it was unbelievable. It was a little unbelievable. I don't know. I think it gets touchy when you start talking about religions and culture and things like that. But the whole book was basically, or, you know, that part of the book, which is probably half the book, was very, very centered on Wiccan. Mm-hmm. Where this woman would, there was one point when basically the groups kind of, they would always bring on new people and new members of their groups would come in at all times. And people would come in and they're like, okay, you're Wiccan now. Oh, okay. I guess I'm Wiccan now. And it was just like, wait, nobody has any opinions about this. I don't know. It kind of pushed very, very pro Wiccan, and it almost to some points it seemed like it was almost like a religious book. You know what I mean? Like if it was the other way, or if it was heavily Muslim or heavily Christian or anything like that, I think it would probably be in those sections at the bookstore. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think it was just it was a little overbearing. But other than that, you know, looking past that and looking past the kind of over explanations of things, it's a really good book. I think that the storyline, the plots, and everything, the way they cross paths, it's really well done. It's nothing to the point of being revolutionary, anything like that, but it's entertaining, and I think that's all that really you can ask from a fiction book like that.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And even in the antagonist character, and you know, like you said, we didn't really go into this because we don't want to spoil the book, and it's a wonderful cover for the fact that I haven't really read it all. No, he's an interesting character, the way he creates his group, so to speak. And I like the whole feudal aspect, the idea that he was a member of the Society for Creative Anachronism, which is, you know, basically a reenactment group for, medieval mm-hmm. type things, which is funny enough, Richard Garriott was actually a member of. That's what influenced his Ultima games. Yeah. And now, you know, yeah, and like in a book I just read, which hopefully we'll be talking about soon, there's this, you know, book called Patriots, and it's a, you know, kind of a half fictional, half field guide story. But in that one, for example, that, you know, one of the lead professors at a college takes over as president, self-proclaimed president of the United States, and I dig on that. I like when you see these people who, you know, going right back to what you were saying with Bethlehem. I mean, he was a guy who fancied himself a learned man and was able to use that to his advantage for this sole purpose of like creating this, you know, feudal army. And I think that kind of stuff is interesting, just the way that the people, that psychological factor that people seem to kind of cling to the need for that, and during a time of, you know, during a fall or during an apocalypse. I've always found that psychology fascinating.
Yeah, and also on the flip side of that, it's almost ironic the fact that our two heroes, Mike and Juniper, are reluctant leaders. You know, mm-hmm. they throughout the book, they're just really like, well, Mike is a little bit more of a kind of a confident leader, where he's, you know, he's ex-military, so he really knows his stuff. But he, at the same time, he doesn't like being called Lord Bear. What is it? Lord Bear, I think is what they call him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't. He kind of doesn't like that, and he doesn't like the kind of, you know, being in charge thing. And Juniper is even more so, where, you know, they start calling her Lady Juniper, and she's like, oh, geez, don't call me that. And she literally gets kind of frustrated at that, and they turn to her because she's a strong figurehead, you know, and it's like a, not so much reluctant, like they still are able to lead and they still are willing to lead, but at the same time, it's like they didn't ask for it. And it's just funny that those two, you know, being the two main characters, I guess, are like that. But then on the other side, like you were mentioning, Duke Ironrod, which is the protagonist's name, he is, he couldn't wait for this day. You know what I mean? Like this is what he built up to. Like you said, just being into that thing. Like he got all of his guys together, and they literally are very much like in Doomsday, where they're, you know, a king and his knights and everything. So it's pretty interesting how you have both sides of the coin there.
Yeah, it's almost like they take what we really like about the post-apocalyptic story, you know, the stereotypes, and kind of give it a nice, interesting little twist. I mean, you can see, you know, like for example, like there's this one group called the Portland Protective Association, and you listen to them, and you're almost like, you know, you could almost, like you said with Doomsday, you could totally make it seem like if, you know, Malcolm McDowell's character in Doomsday was more evil, you know, this is what you would have. Only it's kind of to the point of almost being the Enclave from Fallout. Yeah. You know, it's so good, by the way. You know, I love this, just this mishmash of these different, you know, stereotypes put together. But the idea that, you know, when you're not dealing with this, you know, in the nuclear world where you can't go out there, there's radiation. I mean, it's just a normal world. We just don't have any technology, and it's almost dangerous in that regard. And it's funny because I remember, you know, in fact, it's funny. I had remembered hearing something mentioned about this, and I took a peek at the Wikipedia page, and it was actually listed there, this quote. And it was, I think the guy, he was bagging on the Day the Earth Stood Still movie. He just was playing on it. And he was basically saying, you know, if you want to destroy humanity, you take away our batteries. You know, we're energy based and we can't survive without it. You know, and it's interesting looking at that, because we always joke around about like how intelligent we are and how fast moving we are. But you're right. I mean, we've become so dependent on energy. You take that out of the picture. None of us are really, you know, that old time farming mentality is gone. You know, we're not like our grandparents or their grandparents, you know, in my case, a lot of these, you know, pioneers who came west, you know, if we ever had to make our way, east or west, I'm right there. I've played all the exams and I still don't know what I'm doing. So that's, there you go. But I find that fascinating. I really do.
Yeah, I do too. And I think that it's, there was one review about this book that was saying that it's kind of convenient. Like everything was too convenient where, you know, they had the horse breeder and they had the farmer and they had all these different people who just kind of happened to all know different things to do to survive. You know, there wasn't like, heck, you know, what am I going to do? I mean, I guess as far as my job, like what is a game journalist going to do in the aftermath? But that's, I guess I'm a bad example because I'm actually really interested in, you know, farming and things like that.
So you'll be the example of what to be. Yes.
Now one thing that I guess strikes me too about this is it's very possible. I mean, except for the whole gunpowder thing, I guess, but there is technology out there where there could be a terrorist attack where it could literally be, I forget what those bombs are called, the bombs that like take out, is that an EMP?
Yeah, an EMP, like the ones they fire off in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and it would just take out all
GoldenEye.
Exactly. Yeah, it would just take out all computer, everything computerized, you know, and we would be screwed.
You're exactly right.
And that's one of it's very possible. It's very, very possible. And that's just one of those things where it's like, what would we do? You know, would we try to get all those computers back, or would we go to farming? You know,
You just did reminded me of something very interesting, and I mentioned this because it was kind of a turning point for me. Sometime back we had that Eastern Seaboard power grid failure in the United States, and it was one of those where everybody kind of looked at everybody like, can that really happen? You almost wonder what was going on under the hood there, and you know, I'm sure the conspiracy theorists were just like, But I remember it very well because what had happened was I was on my way home, and this is in, you know, Detroit, in, you know, urban Detroit, and I'm driving home, I'm on the freeway when the power grid went out. And first of all, I remember how long it took me to make it the final mile home, which pretty much was just an off ramp. And then coming up over the hill, and I remember just how cluttered the world suddenly got because all the power was out everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I remember I remember sitting that night, you know, it was extremely hot and humid because it was in the summertime. And I remember sitting outside with my dad looking down the street, and for the first time in my entire life seeing pure darkness. And you could see there were candles in all the houses. And you know, people were coming outside, you know, having barbecues, and you know, kids, all the stuff in their freezers was going to go bad, and we didn't know how long it was going to last, and end up lasting a while. But the reason I say this was a turning point was because I think, you know, I've always been a fan of post-apocalyptic type material anyway, but it was almost like I had this almost like epiphany looking down the street and realizing all this stuff, that just how dependent on the system we have become. And it was almost like, I think that's where my more real life, and I'm not saying I went all off the grid and became a survivalist and went wacko or anything, but it was almost this realization of, you know, how fragile our system can be, and the realization that, you know, some of the real life survival skills would be, that's, I think, where a lot of my interest came about, was the day that it finally clicked for me. Like, you know, it's like this interest in the real life, you know, being off the grid and learning about it was there, because just all it took was, you know, a couple hours of Detroit being off the grid, and you would have thought we were going to have riots. And things did get weird. You know, people started kind of creep out for a while there, and it was like, wow. And it was just the power, you know, and it's interesting because it really clicked at that moment when we were just talking about this. Yeah. Take away our batteries and we have a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned this. Actually, I think this was before our last show, but the power went out here. We had a snowstorm in January. Did I ever mention this on the show? I don't think
I
did.
It rings a bell, and it may have been off off the air, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't remember, but in case I did mention this before, I won't go into detail, but we had a power outage too, and there was a snowstorm. And I live on a really steep hill. There, our street is really, really steep. I don't know what kind of grade it is, but you can't drive. You know, if there's any kind of, even when it rains, sometimes your car will slide, and so it was all snow and ice, and we couldn't leave our driveway, and all the power was out and everything. So basically, we were stuck in our home. This is for only probably 2 days, but I have a fireplace, so we had the fire going, and we literally cooked in the fireplace and everything like that, and we used candles at night. And I was thinking, like, this whole time, in a sick way, it was kind of exciting for me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was one of those things where it's like, I could do this. You know, I could do this. Probably not, you know, in a suburb, in, you know, on the side of a hill, you know, but if I had, you know, like a food stock, and if I had things like that, I could do that. And it's like, I guess, pertaining back to this book, like you were mentioning, it's one of those things where you really, you take those times to sit down and say, you know, this is probably what it would be like, and this is how prepared I would be. And I don't think it would be, it would be bad, but like I said, it's just kind of a strange little, like, excitement, I guess.
Yeah, and we really do live for this stuff. And I don't mean it to sound completely dorky and senile and naive, like, you children, you want the world to end. But at the same time, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like you just get this, we get this automatic rush off of something like this. I mean, this is going to sound so stupid that I'm saying this out loud, because I half laugh that I'm saying this. But there are times when I go up north, and you know, I live on the, you know, border of Nevada and Utah, but you know, I have to go up north into Salt Lake City for my training whenever we do our, you know, HP training or sharp training. And while I'm up there, no joke, while I'm up there, I'm like, please, dear God, don't let the freaking world end while I'm up here, because I don't want to be in the middle of Salt Lake City when it happens. and I half laugh at that too. In fact, because we're talking about, you know, Dies of the Fire, because, you know, there's a part, you know, and I believe it's the third book, where they make reference to a group of Mormons in Twin Falls, Idaho, who have this, like, kind of like retreat group. And I almost start laughing because I know enough people from Idaho and Twin Falls, for that matter, to go, yeah, they would do that. So whenever I'm up there, I'm always like, please don't go, power, don't go out, and world, don't end while I'm up here. Please wait till I get back to St. George. And how dumb is that, that my first reaction to going to Salt Lake City is, don't let the world end. It has nothing to do with, you know, watch out for the crime. Don't, you know, watch out for the crazy drivers up on the freeway. No, it's, please, nuclear war, wait till I get home. And so I officially probably just made a doofus of myself on the air. But yeah, now everybody knows me a little bit better.
No, I actually think that that's probably a pretty accurate thing. I think a lot of people probably think that, especially people like us, you know, where it's one of those things we think about a lot. And I've done that before too, where I've thought, well, like when I go camping or something like that, I've always thought, like, well, if the world ended right now, I'd probably be all right, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, away from the city and everything. I remember when I was growing up, and I lived near Gary, Indiana, and Gary, Indiana is a big steel producing area. And it was like, there was some kind of map I saw somewhere. I forgot where it was, but they showed, like, the Russian targets in the U.S. And one of them was Gary, Indiana. And mm-hmm. I remember thinking, like, okay, you know, if there's a nuclear war, I'm not surviving. So then when we would go on vacation, we'd go down to, like, central Indiana or, you know, southern Indiana and go camping. And I would be like, yeah, if the world ended right now, I'd probably be all right. Yeah.
We do so love our grid.
Yes.
Or lack thereof, I should say.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I think just to wrap this up with this, with Dies of Fire, you know, I recommend everything. Like I said last time with the movies, we always try to recommend everything, but, you know, books are a little bit different because it's more of a time investment. But Dies of Fire is one of those that I think I'm going to kind of pass judgment until I read the rest of them. You know what I mean? I feel like I'm being prepared for the rest of them right now. And mm-hmm. I like what I've read so far. I think that there was someone I was talking to in, I can't remember. I think it might've been Apocalypse Dan, actually. Somebody was talking to me about this series, and they said did you like the first one? And I said, yeah, it was all right. It was not the greatest thing, but I kind of enjoyed it. And he said, well, it gets a lot better in the other one. So, if I'm misquoting that from Apocalypse Dan, it might have been somebody else. It might have even been Bill, one of the regulars. But anyway, so yeah, basically saying that, you know, give the other ones a chance because the other ones in the series actually get a lot better. So I'm excited to actually read those and kind of see how everything progresses.
Yeah, he's got, and S.M. Sterling, he's got an amazing vision of the Apocalypse stuff. In fact, I don't know if a lot of people had figured this out. S.M. Sterling had actually done a Terminator series, book series, three of them. And yeah, it's actually Terminator. I think that what they just called it was the T2 trilogy, but they were a series of books that took place right after Terminator 2's movie. And they were supposed to fill the gap over, you know, them waiting for, you know, after they had helped Miles Dyson knock out, you know, supposedly knock out Cyberdyne, you know, they thought they had stopped it. And it's kind of everything that winds up and things that Skynet are doing to send to try to undo that. And it's actually quite clever at times. I mean, it's some of them. I think there was like three books total. And they start right from the moment that the movie ended. And I never really got a chance to read all three. But I remember really enjoying them. I think the first one came out like back in like 2001 or two. But it was an interesting set of stories. So if you... You know, that might be another one for, you know, to check out because he did an amazing job with that one, too.
Cool. Yeah, I wish I had time to read every book I ever wanted to read.
Oh, I hear ya. Oh, that's my biggest problem because when it comes down to reading or playing a game, I'm like, oh, my ADD won't let me play. Yeah. And that's not at Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, although I could probably apply that somewhere, I'm sure.
I tend to read magazines more, and I'll read them cover to cover, but it's just because it's like kind of short bursts, you know, I'll usually read one magazine. I subscribe to a couple of them, but I'll read one and then I will be reading a book at the same time. And sometimes I get bored and then I'll start another book, and they're not usually similar books. So I don't get them confused. But I tend to do that. Just, it's kind of the way I make alts in Fallen Earth, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But before we wrap this up, I wanted to read a couple emails because we have a few that are about almost a month old now, so I want to get these cleared out here before people think we forgot about them. Okay, so this first one is from Aaron, and he says, I like this. He starts it out and he says, Seanathan. He just merged our names.
That's awesome.
He says, Seanathan, I was enjoying episode 27 today. Oh, hey, that's not too far back. And I heard you casually mention that you had already talked about Earth Abides. He puts that in all caps. And he says, when? Did you record it? Did you take notes? Is the only opinion on the subject worth hearing unavailable to me? Actually, we didn't have a whole show on Earth Abides. I think we just mentioned it, right?
Yeah, I think we just mentioned it in one of our lists somewhere. Yeah. But I'm writing this down as we speak because it sounds like we need to repent and make it further.
Yeah, yes. That's definitely. Yeah, especially if we're called the only opinion on the subject worth hearing.
Well, and we're not. We weren't just labeled the enemy. We were merged as the enemy. We became the AI known as Seanathan.
Character name. There you go.
There it is.
Okay, he says, he goes on, he says, I love that book and the CBS radio version from Escape, and I think it fits into your ideas of self-sustainment and going off the grid. One of the protagonist's chief concerns is that in that book is relearning the tools of survival that had been long forgotten. Also, I'd love to hear you guys talk about how everybody goes tribal in about three generations. Anyway, thanks for providing a first-class podcast for the masses. Peace, A.
Sweet.
Yeah, that's right up my alley right there. The whole going tribal in three generations. I have to try that out. Actually, I think Earth Abides, from what I was reading about S.M. Sterling from Dies of Fire, that Earth Abides actually kind of influenced, if I have that right. I think that's what it was. It kind of influenced.
Who is the writer of Earth Abides? Because I almost want to say I think I know who it is.
Yeah, here it is. George R. Stewart. Yeah, 1949.
I'll be doggone.
I'll definitely have to check that out.
That's right, because it was a pandemic. It wasn't we had like a viral outbreak. That's what it was.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, let's check that out. All right, let's go on to, let's see, next email here. This is from Eric, and this is a long one. This might be our last one. It says, hello, Sean and Jonathan. First of all, I just want to tell you that I love Through the Aftermath. you've both got such deep appreciation and knowledge of post-apocalyptia. Is that what it's called? He puts in parentheses. That's what I call it. And no matter the medium, you discuss with great passion and excitement. You have an excellent chemistry that makes you fun to listen to, and thank you for doing a show. Wow, thanks.
Thanks very much.
He says, I decided to check out your TTA podcast after hearing it mentioned several times by the LifeNet podcast for Fallen Earth. I had played the game in beta, but only recently made the purchase. While trying to find more info on FE, I stumbled onto LifeNet and from there TTA. Now, I listen to both TTA and LifeNet in the background while I play Fallen Earth, and it's a blast. Not sure what I'll do when I catch up with all the episodes. So he's got this next paragraph here, and he calls it How I Got Started on Post-Apocalypse. It says, I got my first taste of PA when my older brother's friend gave up his copy of the original Fallout, titled Fallout, a Post-Nuclear Role-Playing Game, before he moved to Wyoming. I guess they didn't have computers out on the frontier yet. anyway, my two brothers and I played the hell out of that game. My fondest memory was immediately recognizing Richard Dean Anderson from MacGyver and Stargate SG-1 the voice of Mayor Killian Darkwater. That's right.
There's a lot of famous voices in that, right down to Tony Shalhoub, you know, Monk.
Yeah, that's what he talks about next. He says, I would actually argue that Fallout made the careers of Tony Shalhoub, Brad Garrett, and Ron Perlman.
Yep. Yeah, you know, that's funny that he mentions that. That's because it wasn't until years later that I remembered hearing those voices and went, huh?
Who did Tony Shalhoub and Brad Garrett play in Fallout?
Tony Shalhoub was the tribal leader of the first city. Oh heavens!
Oh okay.
Shame on me for getting this. Yeah, he was the leader of.
I think I can picture it. I forget.
Yeah, he was the leader, the tribal leader of Shady Sands, which is like the first village you end up.
That's right.
Coming across in it, and in fact, there's you even have like people like Keith David, who we all know. He does Keith David is you know him from all the the Mass Effect games. He's the admiral, and then of course like the join the Navy. You know, he's that guy. He's in it, and then Clancy Brown, who is he's been in tons of movies, but he's most well known for me as the head guard in The Shawshank Redemption, the one who is like always beating the crap out of people. Yeah, that's Clancy Brown. He does a voice in that as well. But a lot of famous people. It was interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's funny that he's arguing that this game actually made them.
Yeah, he may be right. It's funny that he says that. It's like because nobody knew who they were, and yet Richard Dean Anderson.
He says he goes on. He says, or maybe not. He says, when Fallout 2 came out, my older brother and I pooled all of our allowance money and made the purchase, and then we played the hell out of that. He also bought a strategy guide / tell me where all the cool stuff is book and used it from the beginning. I didn't want to ruin the fun of discovering things, so I didn't use it until my second time through the game. Apparently, I missed quite a bit the first time through. My younger brother bought Fallout Tactics when that was released, but the squad-based game detracted too much from what we liked about the first two games. Kind of a sad ending for Interplay at the time, but wow, were those the days. The funny thing is, as much as I loved Fallout 1 and 2, Tactics not so much, I tried to get my roommate back in college to play Fallout 2, and he quit after dying to the ants at the very beginning.
It's hard. It's interesting going back.
I remember that. Man, I have to try that now. It says, but he loves Fallout 3. Go figure.
Well, that's the thing is, it's funny going back to some of those old games, and I've run into this quite a bit because everybody, who listened to, my other show knows that I'm like, woohoo, when it comes to like talking about the old games. But, we take a lot of things we have nowadays for granted because I'll go back and play and I'll be like, all right, so I needed my quest journal to find out what I, quest journal. I was supposed to write it down.
You're like, I'll ask in local chat. Oh, wait. No, I can't do that.
Exactly. And it's like, oh, dear. Yeah. And it was, those games were hard.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
Good old days. Okay, he goes on to his next paragraph. He calls it show suggestion. He says, in any case, Sean and Jonathan, it's obvious that you guys are enjoying Fallout 3, but have you ever considered talking about Fallout 1 and 2 and or Tactics on a show sometime? I know those games are ancient now, and hardly anyone would trade the graphics in games of today for a great story from 14 years ago. Wow, 14 years ago. But these games were and are just too good to reduce to small references when discussing Fallout 3. I'm sure you've both played them, but would you ever consider doing an episode about the pre-Bethesda Fallout games? Or did I miss that episode? Like I said, I'm new here.
Funny he mentions that, because that's pretty much how the show started, as a matter of fact.
Exactly. That's, yeah, talking about those, and that's, yeah, that, what episode is that of Anthology?
It was episode 20 of the Online Gamers Anthology, and it, you know, there are those, you know, and this is a good point to set the record straight. There are those that actually blame that for setting the downfall of my other show, which actually was not true. It's just, it's a lot easier to do a show when you have two people and you're already passionate about it. But like, you know, Anthology, there are other reasons why, which have all gone away now, but yeah, it's, that's how me and Sean, you know, we knew each other really well through the, you know, just through the blogging side, or the blogging side, excuse me, the podcasting side, but also friends who were bloggers and that type of thing. Yeah. But, yeah, that's when he came on the show and we talked about Wasteland and Fallout. We didn't go so much into Fallout 2, but we did kind of combine the two together, and we went into some pretty hefty detail, even about the original Wasteland as well. And, funny enough, I was actually going back to listen to some of those old ones the other day and listen to that episode, and it was like, it's still like a riot to listen to. So,
yeah. So Eric, go back. You can go to virginworlds.com and check that out and find, Online Gamers Anthology is Jonathan's other podcast.
Yeah.
And, look for that. Yeah, look for the episode 20. And he goes on and he says, FYI, Interplay.com has the Fallout trilogy available for download for $19.99. I always prefer a boxed copy, especially with the box art on these games, but I'm not sure that boxed copies exist anymore. Thanks, Steam. He says, also, I have never seen Mad Max before, but after listening to you guys talking about the trilogy, I've decided that I must get my hands on those movies. I know, fan of PA and haven't seen Mad Max is an oxymoron with emphasis on the latter. Hopefully by watching now, I not only will be able to live my life with less shame for not seeing them, but I will probably be able to pick up on a lot of the Easter eggs I've been missing in my games. Oh, yeah, you definitely will, especially Fallout and Fallout 1 and 2.
Yeah.
You're going to be like, wow, this, like, dog meat and all.
Yeah, you're going to see dog meat and go, wait, could it be because, and we, our first answer is, yes.
Okay, so he kind of finishes this off, his last paragraph here. He does a little Book of Eli review. He says, one final thought. To me, the Book of Eli was so-so. It was good, but it wasn't what I was hoping for, I guess. The scenery and wardrobe were fantastic for a post-apocalypse setting. I think it was Jonathan who likened it to that of Fallen Earth. Very desolate, melancholy, believable. I liked most of the characters, the way they dressed, acted, and then he points to the iPod. What is that, etc. But I think Eli was not done correctly. I'm not saying Denzel was bad, just his character. After learning more about Eli, I immediately began to question earlier parts of the movie. He could hear a motorcycle gang coming, absolutely believable. He wouldn't have been so been seen initially and could know exactly how to hide, even in what seemed like a pretty plain view atop a crumbled overpass. And he ends that with a question mark, like, is that believable? And he says, maybe. But later, he could shoot a gun with pinpoint accuracy in rapid succession at multiple targets whose placement varied in both vertical and horizontal distance from Eli. Really? Even an expert marksman would have to argue that guns, pistols especially, just aren't that accurate, much less the people who wield them, much less Eli for a specific reason. I get it, though. Things are possible in movies, but it's just that was a little confusing. I didn't think the book actually physically enhanced Eli in some way, like Frylock's, which is Aqua Teen Hunger Force, like Frylock's Blue Gem, and he says, did it? I thought the book was powerful for a different reason, which Carnegie addresses as to why he wants it so badly. Overlooking that, the rest of the movie didn't deliver for me. Maybe there was too much walking, or maybe I felt like the movie had a hidden agenda. I did dwell on that when I realized what book Carnegie was after. I'm not saying I hate other people's ideals or even this particular ideal, but I certainly do not like other people's ideals crammed down my throat during a movie I paid to see. That being said, I will likely rent this movie when it's available just to get a better look. Thanks, guys. Hope the podcast continues for a long time. Eric. And he ends this here with a little P.S. He says, oh, P.S., my younger brother and I keep talking about making the big sporting goods store at the mall here our haven when the bombs finally drop. You know, for access to a large arsenal of guns and ammo, not the magazine. Do you think it'd be wise to set up in a place like that, or should we buy all of our guns before 2012 and avoid big public places that others are sure to flock to?
It worked in Dead Rising.
That's true, yeah. More importantly, you don't think they'll actually bomb Wisconsin, do you? No, they won't.
You know, that interesting, though. His take on the movie was actually an interesting take too, because it's interesting, and I say that's interesting because what he gathered out of it was actually quite different one than I gathered out of it, and I think that's where I'm kind of watching this movie going because everybody's kind of taking something different out of it. Like when I watched the movie, I was seeing where he saw the religious aspect was actually where I didn't, and where he where I felt like I did, it seems like he did not. And so, like, for example, that's where I was attributing a lot of, and it probably comes down to what you believe or don't believe, whatever. But, I was thinking, well, the reason he was able to do the things he was because he was technically an inspired man. Like, the voice of God was, Indiana Jones says it best, a voice of God, power stuff, and that's kind of where I was gathering, is that he was somebody who's being inspired to know where they were. But in that, where he was mentioning, the book being what it was and having it jammed down your throat, I was actually, funny enough, I actually kind of went the other way with it. And I thought he probably had it seemed to me like Gary Oldman's character wasn't necessarily a religious man or didn't necessarily believe in it, but knew full well that if you give somebody that kind of religious ability, that people will instinctively flock to it and you have great power through it. Yes. And so it was almost like he was treating it like, the book might just be a book, but people who read this book, even if you don't believe in God, seem to be drawn to it in just the right way. And he knew that in itself it could be a weapon. But it's interesting, though, that he took that out of that context. He was almost, feeling kind of offended, like, hey, whoa, hey, you're trying to put the Bible down my throat. Easy there. But at the same time, it was like, that's cool that he was able to kind of get that take where I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, I think, I think you gave a few spoilers there. But, what I found interesting about his perspective here is it's exactly what I was saying about Dies the Fire with the Wiccan part, where it was kind of like, I don't want to really read all this stuff. I mean, even if I was Wiccan, I think I would kind of be like, I know about this stuff. Like, I don't really want it jammed down my throat. And I think that's exactly kind of what he's saying here, is it's like, without giving away too much about Book of Eli, it's almost like, he didn't want to know about that part of it. It was just a little bit too much information about something that is sometimes a touchy subject, religion or culture or something like that. And I think this is a timely email here because that's exactly what I was saying about Dies of Fire in kind of the same way.
Good point. Good point.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, Eric, thank you for that long email. I don't mind writing long emails as long as they're spelled right. No, as long as they're flowing and they make sense.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely.
This is a very good email. So
that was a really good one.
Yeah, so thank you very much for that one. And I guess we'll get to the other ones, I guess, next time. We have a few from a couple weeks ago, but we'll get to those next time. So,
yeah.
Was there anything else you wanted to touch on before we go?
Yeah, actually, we're gonna set the stage just a tad on what's happening on our next episode, because John is actually not gonna be around that week.
Right.
John's going to the great game developer world in the sky.
Yes, or at least in San Francisco.
Or in San Francisco.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah, I'll be at GDC the second week of March, which is right about the time when we're gonna record the next show. So you want to tell them what you're going to do?
Indeed, yes. We've had a lot of you email and request it. We've mentioned we wanted to do it, and here it comes. We are going to have the almighty intro show, aptly named Through the Intro Math. So, it's going to be kind of taking a break for me and Sean, because Sean's going to be gone. But at the same time, it gives us a chance to kind of go back and listen to some of those original intros. And what I'm hoping to do, and you should have some information by this time, is our goal is to have an overall poll that you guys can vote on of which one is your favorites. And we, hopefully the one after that, we'll be able to announce that. And it partially out of curiosity and partially because I just think it's a riot to be able to kind of vote like the old Dr. Demento, Funny Five radio show type thing, you know, where we can kind of see which of the skits you guys are really enjoying and which ones I'll probably never try to attempt again based on that. So, yeah, so, you know, and more will follow soon here. But, yeah, we'll the next show, you know, good. Get ready for some good old fun intro and, you know, we'll keep those intros coming. Hopefully you have another one a year from now. Who knows?
That's cool. I actually look forward to that and hearing it myself. There, you know, there, we've done what, 29 shows now, and we've only reused maybe three or something like that.
Yeah, two or three. We just had a couple of times where things kind of you know, in the real world overtook, and we had to kind of tone it down a bit. But that's a good point. It's a lot. Quite a few, and that's the one thing is I was like, heavens, you know, hopefully this doesn't end up being a gigantor show, but I actually don't think it'll be that bad once we some of them are a little longer than others, but overall I think they'll be entertaining.
Cool. Yeah, I look forward to it. It'll be really cool. Yeah. Through the Intro Math. That's such
by
a great
Jonathan.
Okay, so cool. That'll be next episode, and then after that, I'm actually GDC is kind of a media event, so there won't really be a chance to meet up with anyone. But later in March, actually 2 weeks after GDC, I will be going to PAX East in Boston, and I'll be spending the weekend there, mostly doing work and things like that. But if there's anyone who's listening who will be at PAX East, shoot me an email, sean@massively.com, or you can do ttaftermath@gmail.com, and just let me know, and maybe we could, say hi. Say, hey, I love your podcast. And I'll say, hey, I love you listening to my podcast.
and then you'll leave. No, I'm just kidding. Hopefully with a designated driver.
Yes. if you want to send us an email that we can read on the show and answer some questions, hopefully, you can send it to ttaftermath@gmail.com. And you can check out our website at throughtheaftermath.blogspot.com. That's where you'll find the show notes for every show. Plus, we have a Twitter account, which is twitter.com/aftermathshow. And, of course, we have a little Facebook group as well. And I guess that's about it. So until next week, this is Sean.
And this is Jonathan saying, stay alive out there. That was the dumbest ending. We have to edit that. That was terrible. I don't know. That was the part where John's brain drops off the planet. Woo! That was really bad. I can't believe I don't even know where I took that. That's...